Okay, why don't we get started, and we'll fold other people in as they arrive. Welcome to the 20th year of our daily work, our daily lives. Somebody once said that, one person said that most marriages don't last 20 years, let alone a brown bag series. And luckily, I've been married 31 years, and other people in the room have been married a long time, too, so I know that that happens. So my name is John Beck, and I'm happy to co-direct with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst here at the museum, Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And it has truly been absolutely wonderful. This is, as I just told Liz, the 199th brown bag in 20 years. So next week, when Don Dupe Dupree is over doing a musical brown bag at the library, that will be the 200th brown bag in our 20th year, which gave us reason to have cake. So there will be cake over at the library next week. And I'll start passing around flyers. Feel free to take as many as you want and give them to friends and family. And then the rest of the series for the fall is on this flyer, so I'll pass that around. And let me call your attention to one last thing before I introduce Liz. And that is that we currently have a brand new exhibit that's still in its final phases of being put up, but most of it is up already. It's called Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, Ore Boats, Workers, and Great Lakes Shipping. And the reason that we did it is it's the 40th anniversary this fall of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. So November 10th is the 40th anniversary. I think it's another one of those things, especially for people in Michigan perhaps, where you remember where you were, you have kind of a memory of the actual sinking. I was an undergraduate here at Michigan State at that time, and I remember quite dramatically how that news affected me. Being a youper, I automatically thought of all of those ore boats that had pulled into our docks in Escanaba, and I'm sure at one point or another, the Fitzgerald would have been one of those. So I'm going to send around, I only have one copy of it, but you might want to note that we have all sorts of things going on in relation to the exhibit, a poetry reading, a couple of different lectures, another exhibit over at the library. So do come out for any and all of those things. So let me introduce Liz. I think Liz always first as an activist, as one of the pioneer women here in the state of Michigan during the 1960s and 70s, who really made kind of contemporary life possible for an entire generation of not only young women, but young men as well, who were trying to get involved in politics, trying to do something about maybe changing the world. And I met Liz back then because of my mentor, my high school government teacher, Elnora Vader, who was a very, very good friend of Liz's back in those days. And so I knew Liz in various of her earlier kind of permutations. Now it's Liz the author, and continuing in her life as Liz the historian. Liz has published Pioneers, Reformers, and Millionaires, which we'll be talking about today, and it really comes out of her work at Turner Dodge House here in Lansing, as well as out of her work at the Women's Historical Museum downtown, the Hall of Fame. It's a real pleasure to have Liz here. She is going to be talking to us today about the Knights of Labor versus Michigan's political machine in the Gilded Age. Now, I just have to tell you one thing, just an aside, and then invite Liz to the podium, which is that I get used to the idea of saying last century. And when I say that, normally I'm thinking 19th. It's a little hard to wrap my mind around the fact that indeed we are a number of years into the 21st century. And for many of us who do 19th century history, it's funny how alive and wonderful 19th century history really is. And we're going to hear today about Liz's work on the Knights of Labor. Knights of Labor are one of those groups that often make it into the history books, but increasingly less so, because that looks more and more like ancient history rather than history that affects us today, even as much as I would argue that it definitely affects us today. There are sign-in sheets, so please do sign in. And with that, Liz, come on up. Please give a warm welcome to Liz Homer, talking about the Knights of Labor and the political machine in Michigan. Thank you.
It's really fun to run into somebody you have known for a long time. And I'd like to mention one thing. I was on the board of the MSU Museum. And I attended some of the earliest sessions of the Brown Bag Lunch. That'd be a long time ago. 20 years. I was a curator at the Moments Hall of Fame and a curator at the Turner Dodge House. So I approached this book and this research differently with that background of activism that I talked about, but also with the interest in particularly providing information about the Turners and the Dodges. It was going to be this small book, you know, the kind that you pick up at a museum and you're just going to read a little about the family that lived there. And then I started to study them there. I had been there for 10 years, and this had been a museum for at least 10 years. But we really didn't know who the Turners and the Dodges were. And that's the part that just, I sparked my curiosity and maybe so much more interested in this period in of the pioneers in the 1900s, because these people were the founders of the state capitol. Now, just think about it. Isn't it kind of odd that here we are all these years and we really don't have any cohesive story that's interesting about the founding of the state capitol? If you ask people, well, what's the story of the founding of the state capitol, they'll tell you, well, when Michigan became a state, and that would be 1837, the Constitution said that they had to move the capitol from Detroit, which they considered dangerous, and move it inland. And then what I found out was they did what you would guess. They argued about it for 10 years, since they didn't really have to do it until 1847, and hold the first session of the legislature here in 1848. So they actually did. Everybody wanted it because that would boom their community. And so there was a big long fight. And in my book then it tells about how they finally came to decide on the state capitol being located here on the Grand River. And I can't tell you that story because it's not part of the Knights of Labor story. But who would think when I was doing this book that I would be writing the story of the founding of the state capitol for the first time, and that I would be writing the woman's history for the first time, the first time we've had an integrated story where the woman's history is mainstreamed into the book. And the labor history kind of fell in the same category as women's history for me. The history that I learned was, you know, there was one page in my high school history book about the women's suffrage movement, and that was about it. I don't really remember if there was a whole page on the labor movement. So there wasn't much. And so I decided to focus my book on those visitors who came to the Turner Dodge House and who came to the Women's Hall of Fame. Because what I heard from them as a curator was that they were really interested in history and they wished they knew more, and they truly believed that if they knew more history, you know, they would be saved from repeating the mistakes of the past. That's what they believed. And so I thought, people need a narrative history because that's how they remember things, attaching it to a story. So this is a narrative history, and it begins then in 1834. And I wanted to read to you just the beginning of the introduction, or the beginning of the book. It begins like this. In 1834, the Niles Register reported that from Detroit that the revivals had reached 960 in one day, up from 175 per day the previous year. The streets of Detroit were full of wagons loading and departing from the west, principally from the region about the Grand River. The character of these immigrants is in every respect a subject of felicitation. They will give Michigan a capital stock of wealth and moral worth unequaled by any of the newly formed states and scarcely approximating Ohio. Remember, we fought with Ohio at the beginning over the border. So that's how it begins, and then it goes through and talks about their involvement. These particular people were from mainly Western New York. They were New Englanders. They came here and they were abolitionists. And among their friends was Austin Blair, who became the governor, and Zachariah Chandler, a leader. Now, we know Zachariah Chandler usually because he was from Detroit and the state senator and so forth. So these people founded the Republican Party because they wanted to end slavery. And one of the things I tried to do in this book is really document it, use lots of primary sources so that people can see this is what the people then said, this is what they thought. And that is because I think we are in for a real confusion over what our history is. So documenting it is extremely important, I think. So they were abolitionists and they formed the Republican Party. And they were consistently described as honest and kind and generous. Now, when you think about it today, we might not even consider those qualifications for being involved in politics. What would a generous person be doing running for office? But that's what they were. They were very, very admirable people. They made a huge difference in our state. But by 1879, those wonderful leaders of the Republican Party were dying off. They were the progressives, they were the idealistic people, they were the promoters of education at all levels. Among them was Senator Zachariah Chandler, who had, in 1879, he had been the head of the Republican State Central Committee, and he was a U.S. Senator most of, I think, about six terms. When he died, what happened was that was kind of marking the end of something, because so many of these leaders were dying. They were being replaced by newer members who were leaders of the party, and those were the oligarchs, because this was after the Civil War, the rise of industrialization, the rise of corporations, and who should step into that void left by Zachariah Chandler but Senator James McMillan. Well, he wasn't a senator at first. And he became the head of the State Central Committee, but that also meant the head of the patronage system in our state. So he had a lot of power in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of stories in there that reveal to you what it means to have a threat of losing your job if you don't vote the way you're supposed to at State Central Committee. So that sets the stage. When I said in my topic, Knights of Labor versus the Michigan's Political Machine in the Gilded Age, it sounds like there's like these two sides about equal fighting, and I would say not so. they weren't really very equal at all. And in fact, I knew very little about the Knights of Labor because I just, you know, there'd be like a sentence or two. They were kind of dismissed. It wasn't really until the AFL came into being that we acknowledged the presence of labor in our state. And how this fits into this book was through Frank Dodge. And so that is near the end of the book, actually, into the 1880s. And Frank Dodge was like the rest of the Turner family in almost every way, the character, influence, values in politics and so forth, but he was a Democrat. By then, that kind of a person was a Democrat. And the thing that kind of got me about this was when I looked at how hard these people fought against the takeover of their party by the corporations and what we call the robber barons and so forth. I had no idea that the average person was out there working so hard to try to win. It's discouraging when I think of the present, where, the idea of winning over the oligarchs is a very difficult one to think about. But also in this time, it was a time when depressions were happening on a regular basis, about every 20 years, so that we had a depression right when we were forming our state. And I hadn't realized that in the past. And then another depression in 1853. And they used to call them panics. So you had the panic of 1873, the panic of 1893. But when you heard the people who were there talking about these were not one-year deals. These were 10-year deals, and in some cases the effects were maybe 20 years from one to the next. They'd barely be recovered and they'd be flopped into another one. And so I tried to explain this it shows in Lansing what it was like as this little community was becoming industrialized along the Grand River, and then they'd be hit by these depressions. And the way I show it is through the Women's Industrial Aid Society, and the very title tells you that these people knew who they were helping. Other people called it the Child's Aid Society, something like that, or the Charity Organization Society, something like that. But they call it the Industrial Aid Society, and I think that's kind of remarkable. But you can see and learn through the book how bad it was and, you know, at what level they were trying to help each other. Frank, as a young man, was educated at Oberlin. His family was from Oberlin. They were founders of that college. And then when Oberlin College people came up here into Eaton County and started Olivet College, many of his family came too, his three brothers and he. And he probably finished school there about the age of 14, and then a little later he went through and got his passed the bar after 2 years of study, which most people thought was pretty remarkable. And then he was elected to the House of Representatives, where he joined the Labor Caucus, which had several members elected by Labor and the Labor Party, and what they call the Fusion Party of the Greenbacks and the Labor Party. And so he was working with them, and at that point they elected passed two bills of importance. One, I always get a kick out of because it was a law that required that if you had a woman working in your factory, she must have a seat. I was thinking maybe we should pass one of those for clerks that work in the grocery stores today, but, you know, I don't see the difference exactly. But anyway, a seat. But the other one was this bill that his seatmate, Thomas Berry, introduced, which was a bill to provide for a 10-hour workday. And I figured out at the time they were working about 12 hours a week in many cases, 6 days a week. And for a salary in the range of $1.25 per day, which works out to under $10,000 in our day. So you can see the poverty that they were living in. Now, I thought in order to get into a story like this, you have to find out who these people were. So I kind of did some research on Thomas Berry. And he lived in Ohio. He was called a burnisher. He burnished the handles of axes. And he had been working since he was 8 years old. So when he was working in the factory in Ohio, he engaged in a little union activity. And he was dismissed, shall we say, unemployed. And he was blackballed. So he couldn't get a job in Ohio, much less in Cleveland. And so he and his wife, Maggie, moved up into the Saginaw area where he became employed for a number of years until his employer joined the Michigan Manufacturers Association. And then he was out of work again. So he became a state legislator, he passed this legislation, and the people who lived in Saginaw, these workers in the plants, decided that they would, that they wanted to have that law implemented right now, the 10-hour workday. And that's when the strikes began. In July 6 of 1885, started in Bay City, went to Saginaw. And then the thing that I thought was interesting about it was how Thomas Berry was recruited to lead them in the Saginaw area. So he's coming from Tuscola County into Saginaw. And so that was fine with the powers that be. They arrested him 5 times. And remember, the Knights were not confrontational. They were still believing in that they could succeed with mediation. They had done research and found that if they could just get to mediation, 85% of their issues would be resolved. And so they believed in mediation, but this is not what the Saginaw mill owners believed in. The mill owners, I guess when I thought about mill owners, I thought about like small businessmen, but they weren't really. Most of them were like on the town council, had more of the levers of power in the area, and pretty much got together and dictated what the status of the workers was going to be. They brought in Frank Dodge, who had been a friend of Tom Berry, to be the attorney representing them. Interestingly enough, they also brought in other very well-known people, like judges, to represent them. I was kind of in here, I noticed a number of times where judges were taking the side of the workers in representing them in the courts. So the total number of cases was he was charged with was about $30,000. And this is what the Lansing State Journal said, because these papers in Michigan were covering all these things. They did not ban coverage of the Knights of Labor and so forth. They would print their meetings, like when they had a meeting in Canada, and what their agenda was, and didn't just ignore them. except for Labor Day. Mr. Dodge is confident he will be acquitted, and it may not be inappropriate to add that when Frank talks that way, the goddess of justice usually takes the bandage off her eyes and balances the scales with careful delicacy. 3 months later, they said, "Our own Frank has carried a peculiarly confiding atmosphere from his youth that somehow impels the witness to hold up both hands and tell everything that he has ever heard about the case from the beginning. And it is worth a mint of wealth to the genial representative." And so that is who is representing them. And not surprisingly, as it went through the court, he won the case and it was dismissed. But the mill owners in Saginaw didn't want it to be dismissed. They wanted a conviction. After all, they had hired Pinkertons from Chicago to break up the strike, each armed with a Winchester rifle and two revolvers. They called in Governor Alger, a fellow lumberman, and requested Michigan troops. Although the troops didn't stay long in the face of so little by the way of violence, anyway, he appeared to be supportive of the mill owners. And I never could conjure up much dislike of Alger. I kind of liked him, but he did do that. One of the Saginaw group of mill owners was Honorable William L. Weber, owner of the Wicks Mill and Salt Block, which employed 60 or 70 men manufacturing lumber and salt. He decided to pursue the civil case in circuit court against Berry and the three others, claiming trespassing and inflated damages for harm done to his premises and the businesses during the strike. Then they brought back Frank Dodge. They go through this case. And then it was interesting to me to find, when I was doing my research, that the person who was handling this case was a former prosecutor on the side of the owners and the people who ran Saginaw, the county officials and so forth. So now he's prosecuting, he has all the inside information, and he's doing the case. Well, Frank brought a number of objections to it, leading the witnesses, cutting off people from testifying, all that sort of thing. And what I found interesting was that the judge, Judge Chauncey Gage, had studied law under this Weber. So, but that was not part of the politics of the day or the common knowledge. I don't know if the Knights of Labor or anybody, journalists, knew that he had studied under Weber. Weber, who was he? He was a agent for the railroads who bought and sold land from Saginaw all the way up north along the roads. And by this time, he was turning millions of acres of land. And so he was what we would call a millionaire today. And he was also once a state representative, a Democrat. So So when this Judge Chauncey Gage did the, found them guilty, he only charged award damages of $290 compared to $30,000 that was claimed. So everybody was really happy, but not Frank Dodge, because he was angry. They were charged and found guilty of conspiracy, and he said they did not conspire to do this, and so he wouldn't take it. So he appealed to the Supreme Court. And through the Supreme Court story, the legal documents of the Supreme Court, especially the dissent opinion of Judge Sherwood on the Supreme Court, you can find out what really, really happened almost on a daily basis during the strike and what the findings were. It was almost like, you know, it was a 17-page dissent. It was almost like he was leaving it for us. So you want to know what really happened? Here it is. And so I show that in the book, what happened. Many, many unfairnesses, which I won't get into all of them, but it was pretty bad. The Saginaw Valley strike has been judged by some historians to be the most important strike of the 19th century in Michigan. It was an important early battle against the injustices the workers suffered and that individual workers were powerless against. Protection against unfair working conditions for which the Saginaw lumber workers went on strike did not become a reality until the next century, when the laws regulating hours, wages, and working conditions were granted and adopted, and we thought we had won. So I think, and that was put on a legal milestone by the State and Saginaw County Bar Association in 1988. So it's still there to commemorate the no hours or no sawdust strike. But most of us don't know this story at all. And we don't know women's history at all. We don't know the founding of our state capitol story. And does this make a difference to us? I just saw a political scientist from U of M lamenting the fact that we have no common story. And some of our history that in the books that we have are mainly telling us kind of like the book by Dunbar, they're telling the dates and they're telling what happened, but you don't have any sense of what happened. And he certainly doesn't tell you anything of women's history or labor history. So I don't know if the day will come when we'll have more. I don't know. After that happened, you would think, well, that's the end of it. Those Saginaw people got what they wanted, more or less. It should be over. There was one really neat thing I found out. You know, this idea of working conditions, guess who picked up on it and was successful in Lansing? The shop owners. In Lansing, even the bustling shop owners in North Lansing tried many times to band together to reduce their weekly hours by agreeing to be closed earlier. Their pack never seemed to work because somebody was always breaking the pack to get an advantage. Until June 13, 1887, one anonymous shopkeeper who had been in the trade since 1849, meaning the trade as a shopkeeper, explained why he favored early closing. For all these years, I have never had one weekday evening to myself. My time has been from 6:30 to 9 and 10 p.m., much of the time without dinner. My help came at 6:30 and 7:30, and they stay till 9 p.m. Most laboring men kick at 10 hours with 1 hour for dinner. The lady help in my store only take 30 or 40 minutes for dinner. I don't think there is a farmer within 40 miles that cannot come in during the hours, the shorter hours, and do all the shopping that he wants to, and the laboring men in the city trust most of their shopping to their wives. I don't think anyone will be discomforted by the early closing, nor closing not near as much as the 500 or 600 clerks in the stores. 2/3 of whom are ladies, I believe they will be benefited. That evening, the people of Lansing celebrated the inauguration of the early closing hours in the city. They joined together in music, fireworks, a procession headed by a band, and an address. So we never think of business history, do we? But that's kind of in the book too. Now the next final section of my book, I only have a short time to talk about, is about Milo H. Dakin from Saginaw, the first person to ever be impeached by the state legislature. We think we are seeing an amazing event now, but this happened in 1885. There were many things that the Knights of Labor were doing and that are in the book besides these events. One was that they collaborated with the Women's Christian Temperance Union to petition the legislature to raise the age of consent, which they wanted to raise to 18 years old. And guess what? It was 10. We were right there in the Taliban period of our history. So the Knights of Labor were doing that kind of thing. And I had no idea of that. In fact, all through the book, I had no idea that there were so many men who were supporting the rights of women. That, when you abolish women's history, you abolish that too. The Knights of Labor had the power to vote. In 1885, they elected not just one of the four House of Representatives from Saginaw County, but two. The city of Saginaw representative was Milo H. Dakin. Dakin was the local official of the Knights of Labor and had been their treasurer. He was a member of the Grand Army of the Republic and had marched with Sherman from Atlanta to the sea. He was in every major battle at the end of the war. Not only were they electing state representatives, but the Knights in Saginaw, following this big strike, you know, they were electing aldermen to the Saginaw City. Now, in 1886, businessmen and officials of Saginaw, the city of Saginaw and the smaller city of East Saginaw, began to push legislation to approve consolidation of the two warring cities that they emphasized would create one harmonious metropolis of 60,000. But what happened was that Representative Milo Dakin was supposed to introduce this legislation, but he didn't follow the ruling clique's orders. He involved the Knights of Labor in developing this legislation. Now, here's what's behind it. There's always something behind it. And why they were all on a to-do. And that was that there was a former governor, David Jerome, and he wanted control of the bridge that would be crossing the Saginaw River. He wanted that control because he had the only trolley line in the area, and they had built a racing park. They called it a driving park. And the driving park was actually a racetrack. See, so all this traffic would go over that bridge and he'd collect the money. So he'd make tons of money over the long haul. The monopoly of the bridge would be worth thousands of dollars to him in future profits, and he wanted to block a movement to build a free public bridge. Have we heard this story before? Dakin opposed Eaton's run for alderman. Eaton was the attorney for this group of the clique that ran Saginaw, principally. East Saginaw didn't really have much of a say in anything. Dakin had gotten himself into trouble with the attorney named David Eakin because by opposing him, he didn't get chosen to be the attorney in the next year, which was about $500 worth of salary, which was a sizable amount that day. So he had gotten those people mad at him and the people who wanted the bridge control. And then he had kept them from choosing replacements on their council in hopes of getting a person that the Knights supported, John Shackleton, in as mayor. He was going to be mayor, and so they just stalled the whole thing so John Shackleton could make the choices. This is all the petty politics that goes on every community all the time. Then he and this guy named Fuller, who was also a Knights of Labor on the council, had the job of lobbying for the consolidation of Lansing and East Lansing, or Saginaw and East Saginaw. They were not wealthy people. This Fuller was a conductor on a trolley, and Eaton was a shingles inspector in a factory. So they didn't have a lot of money, and they found that this was costing them a lot of money, so they happened to think that they would meet with this Eaton, the attorney for the Saginaw, and talk about the problem. Now, he was saying that they really couldn't do much more on their own salaries, that they feared it was going to cost $5 or $10 per legislator, maybe $125 to do the lobbying they needed to do. But calculate, that was over $3,240. It's a lot of smooching and small things that they were buying. They weren't like giving each of them $1,000. So Dakin convinced them that they should make a list of legislators that needed this kind of gifting. You kind of think to yourself, is this really big enough to be called a bribe? But then, when the thing was with Milo Davis, is this Eaton, he knows is not his friend, but he starts taking this list, which was just a list of the House of Representatives, and writing down the ones, checking them off, who needed to have. He needed to use money with, that was the term they used. And so he said, well, write down how much money for each one. So he puts down $5 or $10 on this list. So what did Eaton do with the list? He immediately sat down, wrote a letter, took it to the House, and then used it as proof that he was bribing the legislators. Well, that's how Frank Dodge got involved. He was asked to represent Dakin in the legislature during the trial. And he had received, he had a very fine reputation for fairness. That's why they chose Dodge to represent him. Backing him up was the judge from Charlotte, and the judge from the trials in Saginaw. So they had high power, high status people represented them. And the things that came out of this trial were just incredible. And one of my favorites was the fact they had a thing called the Third House. The Third House was had officers that were elected like the House of Representatives had elected officers. A chairman, a secretary, and so forth. And they used this committee to buy things that they wanted and do extra sort of business for the legislators. And And he brought this up, and everybody knew it was true, so it wasn't arguing about whether this occurred or not. But he was trying to show, look, this is the context for which this Milo Dakin figured he was going to have to use money with the legislature. And more or less, these committees, some of them just said, if you want to talk to us about legislation, you have to give us stuff. And it would be like oranges, cigars, that kind of thing. But remember, those were high-priced items in that day. So there was even the unofficial House assess those doing business before the legislature. Assess them. They never in all this used the word lobbyist. It was never used. And they had a sign up this, and I'm not sure exactly what this means, but they're trying to tell them before it goes over. This, they had a sign up that said, we smoke. If you don't, up goes your bill. That's one of those oddball things, but that's what it meant. The testimony even revealed that when the third House members recently observed that they had failed to get a customary gratuity of $100 for the reverend who came and gave the prayers, they sent a letter to all the U.S. Senate candidates, because in those days the legislature picked the U.S. Senate, and asked them for donations for this. But most of them didn't send anything back. They had testimony on behalf of Milo Davis by this man named Jerome V. Shank, a journalist for the Lansing Sentinel. He said that this Eaton, Fred Eaton, came in with three other gentlemen to the office of the newspaper, and he quoted them as saying, we are down here to knock out Dakin. And another time, Shank said that they said that we're after his scalp and we mean to have it. So that's motive. Then when it came to cross-examination, this poor man, who was, I was sympathetic to because I knew his brother from the things I was writing and the Shanks. And his wife had died like 20 years previously. And at that time it was so traumatic that his family took his children for a year to care for them. Well, he kind of pulled himself together. And so they accused him of being a nut. And they also said he wore glasses and actually couldn't see, which, you know, he was a journalist. So can't bend too hard to see. And then Eaton simply said he was never at the Sentinel. So that all that testimony was dismissed. The thing that got me was just winding up quickly, that the public was not with Milo Dakin. The coverage was extensive. They didn't cover a lot of the defense part of it. And so he was, when he was prosecuted and found guilty of the intention to bribe, not that he actually bribed. People cheered. That was good. The House balconies were packed. And his shame was carried in all the newspapers, Knights of Labor representative bribing the legislature. But there was another wrinkle to the story. The Senator Chauncey Wisner was from Saginaw County, and he was to continue with this process of, shall we charter a city. And so he gave a wonderful speech in which exonerated Dakin. He spelled out the things that this Jerome was doing regarding the bridge, and he spelled out the character of Dakin and all that had happened. And that turned everything around after this first impeachment. And this is how he ended it. And as long as Milo Dakin's ghost walks these quarters, and his blood stains that map, so long as the sobs of his wife and the tears of his disgraced children cry to heaven for justice, so long will the spirit of consolidation march on. So that speech was then printed in all the papers in the state. I don't know if you would call it by way of apology, but anyway, it was. And it did help to exonerate Milo Dakin somewhat, but he did not go back to the legislature after that. But you can imagine after the way these Knights of Labor were dragged through the mud, what a high price to pay. I mean, basically will ruin your life. That summer it was reported that Frank was off for a well-earned vacation. He went to Pine Lake, which is over, you know where Pine Lake is? And then he took a trip up into the Upper Peninsula. And I should mention to you that this group of people, Frank Dodge, his brother-in-law, James Turner, were major, and another cousin, John Longyear from Marquette, were the ones who came up and did all of the development in the 70s and 80s in the Upper Peninsula. And usually they're referred to as investors or developers from Lansing, and that's all we know about them. So this enlightens that whole section of the story. So that's what I know about the Knights of Labor. And it gives you just kind of a window into who they were. And when we wonder about why labor has such troubles, the sides are so unequal that I guess we need a union. You know, I have thought, why was he a Democrat? First of all, when he was born, the Civil War was over, and the issues of slavery were over. And he lived in Eaton County, and he studied law under this man named Isaac Christian. And that guy was very cool. He was a wonderful attorney, a wonderful person, and he was a Democrat. And I'm guessing that pulled him into the Democratic camp.
Because that's fairly uncommon at that time in Michigan, right? I mean, it's not like the Democratic Party was that strong in Michigan by comparison.
That's true. And they were always factionalized. They were always fighting all the time. They could never get it together. In this book, though, is a fabulous story of how James Turner took on the Republican Party. One of the things we lack now are reformers in the Republican Party. Think of it. Can anybody think of any? So those reformers within the Republican Party, including this James Turner, were fighting to get it back. They were the beginning of the Progressive Party, and they were beginning this in 1890. So they were early before there was a national progressive movement going. And Frank Dodge supported his brother-in-law in many ways, but he did keep with the Democratic Party. And then at the end of the book, well, in the last chapter anyway, he forms the County Board of Supervisors. And I always thought, why did he form the County Board of Supervisors when he had all these other interests? And the County Board, it's a very interesting story. He immediately invited Hayes and Pingree to come and speak to him about the corruption in the state. And Pingree was a Republican and a reformer that James Turner had helped to get elected. But the story in the second part of the book, which parallels what we're living through now in many ways, it's very horrible. the worst political stuff I've ever read, but that was up to the last go-round. They formed a county board of supervisors because the Democrats had no power or strength or support. The county board of supervisors, of which he was one, and this guy named, I think, James Ewing, the two of them formed it. They were both Democrats, and they were both county supervisors. They were trying to organize the supervisors at the county level as a balance against the corporations, because the corporations were the last word of what was going to happen in the legislature. And so to bring this grassroots organization, which they formed, into life to challenge them, to have a speaker. Frank Dodge was often the lobbyist for the County Board of Supervisors. So that's a whole twist that we don't know about.
Okay, other questions or comments? Sure.
Sometimes you find somebody who you don't think of as was real important in a particular group, but they were there for a little while. Did you run into people from the 30s, 40s, whatever, who had had some time period that they were attached to the Knights or saw themselves that would surprise us?
No.
Okay.
I mean, after these things with Miles Davis and Frank Dodge and so forth, my story goes up to the Upper Peninsula, follows the suffrage movement, because I'm following this group of people and their story. And so I don't get those other names coming into it, I'm sorry to say. The book actually ends in 1912. Because it covers the span of Marion Turner's life from when she came to Michigan until she died in 1912.
Well, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. My copy's up front there.
Good, good.
Dorothy? Yeah, you're describing very well the what I call, for that period of time, the upper class, or the laborers.
Well, in the first part of the book, for example, the people were mainly English, Scottish. John Longyear was German, but they were mainly, many of them were descendants of the Pilgrims.
Descendants of what?
Of the Pilgrims. They went back to the Pilgrims. And the Monroes had been not exactly pilgrims, but they had been fighting against Cromwell in England, and then they were massacred by Cromwell, the Monroe clan, and many of them were sent here as slaves.
See, what you're describing is English-speaking people, right? The Scots as well. But are there other nationalities in that group, in the everyday laborer class?
It didn't. Germans did come into Lansing, Central Michigan, and there were some Irish. The Italians were disliked. That kind of thing. But the thing about this that kind of got me, because I was trying to look for it, I didn't see racial animosities in this community, this little community, in the 1800s. Now, something happened there because they did come. But for example, the one group that I did see was blacks that came, and there were 15 African Americans in 1850 in the census for Lansing. But you're talking about just a handful of people, and mainly the people that came were related to each other in some way. They already knew each other. They essentially came from Vermont, then they were recruited into Western New York, and then they came here to settle along the Grand. So you didn't see a wide spread of ethnicity. In the beginning, you'll see this curious situation where people, they were not class conscious, and they often spoke in the later years about what it was like to be a pioneer, not a settler, but a pioneer, the first. They came and they knew each other, even if they didn't know each other before they came. There was much more moving about, much more communication in Ingham County, Eaton County, Clinton County, than I thought. I would have thought they would be more isolated. They knew the Indians, the Ottawa, Potawatomi, and the Chippewa, Okemos tribe. They knew him, they mentioned him a lot, but they seemed to like him. They saw him as a very affable person. So there is some about him. And so I didn't write about that because it wasn't there. But I'm looking at documents like the newsletter, or the State Republican, stuff like that. That's, and those people that were writing the State Republican were abolitionists. Yes. So their view of the world probably wasn't exactly the same as everybody else's. In fact, these were radical Republicans. And they were not, you know, the main force within the Republican Party. That, but if I had found anything, I would have written it.
Greater Germany kind of thing. So it would be.
Yeah, I remember.
seed companies, and those had a lot of non-English speaking women workers, for example. But I don't think Legacy did. I don't think we had.
No, because you had this kind of spotlight shown on the poor in the area, who were the, that I mentioned, the Industrial Age Society and how they were helping them. But you didn't see in what they were talking about issues related to ethnicity.
But I don't know all the, I mean, I don't know what factories if you took a poll of 1900, what's the wholesale legs of factories, and I don't know all those, so maybe that there were certain ones that did pull some people from, you know, one place, and then people brought other people who wrote back and said there's a good chance for people to like, so you see more. My guess is that mostly it was a little too, your story is just a little earlier than what you would have guessed.
Other questions or comments? Just one quick thing on class consciousness, of course, is that the Knights, you know, really went out of their way to only keep out bosses and lawyers. As I remember writing from the, you know, kind of the original notion that everybody could be, in effect, kind of a knight of labor. And since they were much more philosophical, I think that it ended up being much more a movement than it was a trade union at various points in its life. I mean, it grows meteorically because of the 8-hour day fight in Chicago and elsewhere. And I think it's not really on the back of that movement that a lot of people flowed into the Knights, even though you'll find them in my work on dock workers, you find them on the Cleveland docks, among Finnish ore unloaders. You find them in a variety of places that there are Knights of labor locals in different locales.
That's kind of my point to Liz earlier, that I wondered if you looked at somebody who dies in 35 or something like that, if they didn't have a few years that they saw themselves as a Knight in the middle 1880s.
Mm.
Because of where they were, or who they were friends with, or whatever, but by that point, there's something very different. As I was saying earlier, somebody like the first president of the Michigan Federation of Labor spends time as a Knight, and spends time as a socialist, et cetera, et cetera. So it was kind of, there was a lot of, nothing was really going to win. You wanted to make things better in certain ways, but you try different things, and that way you run through different political parties or labor types or whatever. So I would guess some of the people that maybe colleagues of those folks, whatever, some of them might have spent some time as Knights, but it would be a real brief period of their life.
Yeah, I think that I think what you're saying is that the movements are all semi-permeable membranes, and people just kind of, you know, migrate across from this to that to something else.
Certainly true of Lambert, I mean, so I assume that it was true for him, it would be true of other people that were sort of around him.
Well, and the other thing I would raise, Liz, and I think that it's really interesting in relation to what you're looking at, is that so much in the way of Michigan politics is local in this time, it's just so strongly local. So labor parties take over different Upper Peninsula communities coming out of the 1895 iron strike in Marquette and some of the other kinds of uprisings. You see labor parties sweep into office and take the majority in different cities.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating story. So people who were, you know, political one day happen to have been trade unionists the day before, but many of those unions don't continue to exist. But a lot of those folks jump from one movement to another and from one union to another, as John has indicated.
Yeah.
Very, very true.
There's a great story in there about the Pullman strikes in the Lansing story, because the Pullman strikes made a huge impact here. And I didn't realize how big it was. They printed the entire conspiracy trial transcripts in the Lansing State Journal, or in the Lansing Republican. And when they finally had Labor Day, which they had already had Labor Day strikes or parades in Lansing, the leader of that made a huge impassioned speech about the threat of these oligarchs to them as laborers. And so that Labor Day strike or parade had hundreds and hundreds of participants, and they'd have all these locals, and as they point out, they're all wearing their work clothes, they all look the same, but they're marching and marching and marching, and there's people coming from all over on trains, and they're up in the upper second floors of the buildings, hanging out and all around. And there was a huge statement about it, and he's like, and they were afraid, I think. I mean, that guy was Irish. He was genuinely afraid after that Pullman strike.
Well, let us give Liz another round of applause. Thank you so much for coming.
Bye.